Welcome to the Shortwave Report for February 10th, 2012. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio and a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find a schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past four shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from China Radio International, NHK World Radio Japan, Radio Havana Cuba, and The Voice of Russia. We'll begin with China Radio International. Like much of the world, China is facing a future with a need for more fresh water. Desalination of seawater is increasing, but there are many serious problems with this method. China Radio International.
Most of China's economic zones are located along its eastern and southern coastlines. About 70% of the country's GDP comes from these areas, which comprise one-fourth of the country's territory. As water shortages along the coastlines and beyond become more severe and threaten both industry and residential areas, many are looking at seawater desalination as a significant supplementary resource. There are two main technologies used in seawater desalination: thermal and membrane desalination. To put it more simply, thermal desalination vaporizes seawater, while membrane desalination filters salt from seawater through a special membrane. Tianjin is a large coastal city that has developed the seawater desalination industry. Its desalination plants can process about 250,000 tons of seawater a day using both desalination methods. The water is mainly used by manufacturing enterprises along the coast. Zhang Kai is deputy director of the Tianjin Water Environment Research Institute. He says, although desalinated water is potable, moving it through the city's tap water pipes to homes and offices has limits.
Because many of the ions are removed in the desalination process, the ion balance is broken. The desalinated water may erode pipes as it is transported. So when it comes out from normal water pipe, it is yellow because it contains a lot of rust. The water quality is different from that of tap water.
Beijing is one metropolis with a severe water shortage. The city is about 100 kilometers from Tianjin, fairly close to the seawater desalination plants. But transporting desalinated water from the Tianjin plants to China's capital would not be cost-effective. And as Beijing sits at a higher altitude than Tianjin, there will be additional problems in transporting desalinated water. Even in Tianjin, the adoption of desalinated water on a large-scale basis faces some obstacles. One of them is from the market, Zhang Kai says.
For instance, the current price of surface water in Tianjin is more than 1 yuan per ton. Desalinated seawater costs 3 to 5 yuan per ton, and the equipment depreciation is not even counted. If it is counted, the price may rise to 4 to 8 yuan per ton. That's because the technology and infrastructure cost more money than tap water.
Zhang says another problem with using desalinated water is environmental damage.
Seawater desalination has some effect on neighboring environment. The wastewater from desalination has a high salt density. Discharging it has some effect on the ecosystem. Unlike the situation in Singapore and Australia, China's Bohai Bay area is an inner sea. There's no strong current which can effectively take the highly salty water back to the Pacific.
Despite these limitations, desalinated water will play a greater role in the near future in helping to alleviate the country's water shortages. Zhang Kai says Tianjin has plans to better use its abundant regional seawater resources. By the year 2015, the city expects its desalination plants to process 460,000 tons of seawater a day. For CRI, I'm Li Dong.
That report was from China Radio International, heard from 4 to 5 p.m. at 11970 and from 6 p.m. to 11 at either 9790, 6020, or 6190, or on the web at english.cri.cn. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Standard Time, so adjust them to your time zone. On to NHK World Radio Japan. There has been an increasing rise in the temperature of one of the reactor cores at Fukushima. Attempting to cool the situation with water has not yet been effective. High levels of cesium have been detected in earthworms over 100 kilometers away from the Fukushima reactors, thus entering into the food chain. Japan's Nuclear Safety Agency plans to approve stress tests on two nuclear reactors, but the local population is very skeptical. South Korea has resumed negotiations with Turkey to build new nuclear reactors on the Black Sea coast. Pakistan has told Iran that it wants to go ahead with a natural gas pipeline despite objections by the United States. NHK Japan.
An apparent rise in temperature at one of the reactors at the damaged Fukushima nuclear plant is troubling its operator. Tokyo Electric Power Company says the temperature did not go down even after it increased the volume of cooling water on Tuesday. One of the thermometers at the bottom of reactor number 2 at the plant showed a rise in temperature to about 70 degrees Celsius beginning on January the 27th. It had been steady at about 45 degrees before the rise began. In an effort to lower the temperature, the amount of water streamed over the reactor's fuel rods was raised by 3 tons to 13.5 tons per hour Tuesday morning. But Tokyo Electric said readings were down by only about 3 degrees after 5 hours, a minimal improvement. The utility said the flow of water in the reactor may have changed after plumbing work in late January, possibly causing difficulty in cooling some of the fuel rods. It added that no temperature rise has been observed on two other thermometers in the same reactor, and that it will continue to carefully monitor the reactor. The operator has been unable to visually confirm conditions inside the reactor since the nuclear disaster in March because of high radiation.
Researchers say high levels of radioactive cesium have been detected in earthworms caught in areas around the damaged Fukushima Daiichi plant. The researchers from the Forestry and Forest Products Research Institute checked cesium levels in earthworm samples they collected at 3 locations. The institute says about 19,000 becquerels of cesium per kilogram of worms were detected in Kawauchi Village, 30 kilometers from the plant. About 1,000 becquerels in Otama Village, 70 kilometers from the plant, and 290 in Tadami Town, 130 kilometers away. The institute says the cesium levels rise in proportion to the radioactive levels of topsoil containing decomposed leaves the worms feed. The chief researcher at the institute, Motohiro Hasegawa, says boars, birds and other forest animals feed on earthworms. He says the radioactive impact on these creatures will need to be constantly monitored to prevent contamination through the food chain.
Japan's Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency plans to approve safety tests on two nuclear reactors in central Japan in a final report scheduled for submission shortly. The agency says a panel of experts on Wednesday agreed to complete their evaluation of computer-simulated stress tests for the two reactors at the Oi nuclear plant in Fukui Prefecture. The government tests were ordered last July for suspended reactors in an effort to win the consent of municipalities hosting nuclear power plants. The agency says it has concluded that the tests have been conducted appropriately. It says sufficient safety measures have been taken for the reactors to counter quakes and tsunami as powerful as those that hit the Fukushima Daiichi plant. The final decision on whether to restart the reactors, however, lies with the government. Even if it decides to give the go-ahead, local municipalities will be difficult to convince. Many complain that the official assessment of the Fukushima accident is not complete yet and that the stress tests have been done just to ease local anxieties.
South Korean President Lee Myung-bak and Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan have agreed to resume negotiations on a stalled project to build nuclear reactors on Turkey's Black Sea coast. At summit talks held in Istanbul on Sunday, Yi expressed interest in having South Korea participate in Turkey's nuclear power plant project. The two countries had signed a memorandum of understanding in June 2010 to prepare for the construction of the reactors, but talks broke down in November the same year after the sides failed to resolve key differences. Japan then tried to replace South Korea and finalise a similar deal, but the talks were suspended following the accident at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant last March. Political analysts say Turkey likely aims to seal deals that better serve its interests by having Japan and South Korea compete for contracts.
Pakistan has told Iran that it is committed to pushing ahead with a bilateral gas pipeline project, despite opposition from the United States. Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari met with Iran's Vice President Ali Saidlau in Islamabad on Tuesday. Zardari said the project needs to be implemented early to meet the ever-growing demand for energy in Pakistan. The visiting Iranian Vice President said Iran has already laid piping on its side of the border and expressed hope for the start of construction on the Pakistani side soon. The US is trying to persuade Pakistan to give up Iranian natural gas imports. It believes the project will benefit Iran, which the US condemns for what it claims is a nuclear weapons program. Pakistan is stepping up energy cooperation with Iran in a bid to address serious energy shortages at home.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 9 to 9:30 p.m. at 6110 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. Wednesday saw 10 more Pakistan civilians killed by U.S. drone missile strikes. In the Armed Forces Journal, a U.S. soldier has contradicted positive reports of accomplishments in the war on Afghanistan. There is to be an expansion of U.S. Special Forces in Afghanistan. Then a viewpoint on the 50th anniversary of the U.S. blockade against Cuba. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Missiles fired from a U.S. drone killed 10 civilians in Pakistan's North Waziristan region near the Afghanistan border on Wednesday, according to area residents and Pakistani security officials. In the attack, a drone fired two missiles at the house suspected of being a militant hideout in the village of Thapi, about 10 miles east of Mirashah, the main town in North Waziristan. The United States stopped the drone program, a major element of its war in neighboring Afghanistan, after a NATO air attack last November from across the Afghan border killed 24 Pakistani soldiers, enraging Pakistani officials and local residents. Pakistan views the attacks as violations of its sovereignty that produce unacceptable civilian casualties. The United States resumed attacks with the missile firing drones in January.
A U.S. Army whistleblower who has served in the military since 1985 has come public to warn that the U.S. mission in Afghanistan is failing and the American public is being misled. Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis says his recent trips to Afghanistan bore no resemblance to rosy official statements by U.S. military leaders about conditions on the ground. In an article published in the Armed Forces Journal, Davis writes, "How many more men must die in support of a mission that is not succeeding?" Davis goes on to say that local Afghan governments are unable to provide the basic needs of the people and that insurgents control virtually all parts of Afghanistan beyond eyeshot of a U.S. base. U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said last week that he expects a transition from combat to training to begin by the middle of 2013, but now Pentagon officials are admitting plans are being made to expand the role of U.S. Special Operations Forces inside Afghanistan. According to the New York Times, these forces could remain in the country well after the NATO mission ends in late 2014.
It was 50 years ago today that Washington officially imposed its economic, commercial, and financial blockade against Cuba. On February 3, 1962, then-US President John F. Kennedy gave the green light to a policy that sought to destroy the nascent Cuban Revolution. Ignoring that global appeal for an end to this inhumane and illegal measure, Nine U.S. administrations, both Republican and Democrat, have maintained and often intensified this criminal measure. Such is the case of the Torricelli and Helms-Burton Acts, enacted in 1992 and 1996 by U.S. Presidents George Bush and Bill Clinton, whose aim was to tighten the siege against Cuba while trying to prevent, by any means necessary, Cuba's trade with third countries. This genocide affects sensitive areas such as health, education and nutrition of the Cuban people, causing damages of more than $950 billion, to cite just one example. The United States General Assembly, every year since 1992, has openly rejected this hostile policy to starve the Cuban people into submission. The most recent vote at the United Nations for lifting the blockade was last October, when 186 countries demanded it be ended. On that occasion, the United States and its ally Israel were the only two votes against the United Nations resolution against the inhumane and illegal U.S. blockade. The measure, arbitrarily imposed by a United Nations member country against another, which resists such aggression full of dignity, violates the principle of international law and constitutes a violation of the peace, development and security of a sovereign state. It is also an act of war applied during times of peace and contravenes the principle of sovereign equality and non-intervention to arbitrarily put into practice economic and political sanctions to coerce another state. Despite the official rhetoric that seeks to convince international public opinion that current U.S. President Barack Obama has introduced a policy of positive changes, this is, however, the period of greatest persecution of Cuba's international financial transactions, including multilateral cooperation. This failed policy turns 50 years old now. However, the many obstacles imposed have not prevented Cuba from exhibiting positive rates equivalent to those of developed nations in the areas of health, education, and sports. And, as recently affirmed by Cuban President Raúl Castro, we know that the blockade will continue and that the United States will increase its attempts to convert a handful of local mercenaries into a destabilizing opposition, but that will not take away the dream of a revolutionary people. For Radio Havana, Cuba, Editorial Desk, I am Eduardo González.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba, heard from 2 p.m. to 3 at 11760, and from 4 p.m. to 11 at either 6060, 6010, or 6000. Also streaming on the web from 4 to 11 p.m. at www.radiohc.cu. And now podcasting at World Radio Network, which is wrn.org. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or would like to make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. I'm grateful for a donation from radio station KQRP in Modesto, California. Please help support this show if you can. We will conclude with the voice of Russia. Russia, along with China, vetoed a UN resolution about Syria, saying that the Western media is misrepresenting the ongoing civil war in the country. Anonymous, a loose-knit collective of hackers, are breaking into government agencies like the FBI, Brazilian banks, and Swedish government sites. They claim their actions are to preserve freedom of speech. The voice of Russia.
Sergei Lavrov, Russian foreign minister, and Mikhail Frykov, head of the Foreign Intelligence Service, arrived in Damascus to hold talks with President Bashar Assad. The Russian foreign ministry on Sunday said that the purpose of the trip was to stabilize the situation in Syria through democratic reforms.
Evgeny Primakov, former Russian foreign minister, writing in an article in the pages of the Российская Газета, said that the situation that surrounds Syria, much like Libya, has not from the outset fit the mold of the Arab Spring, which has been characterized as popular uprisings against the authoritarian regimes in the Arab world. In particular, from the very beginning, these two countries have seen military action against the government.
Primakov writes that the origination of the weaponry and who organized these cells remains to be seen. I am sure that eventually there will be some light shed on these issues. From the very outset, media in the West and in some Arab countries took a biased, one-sided position in covering the events. The media described only the suppression of peaceful demonstrations demanding democracy.
What they did not show is that Syrian authorities cancelled emergency rule, refused to support the political monopoly of the Ba'ath Party, introduced political competition and announced democratic presidential and parliamentary elections. A significant part of Syria's population, if not the majority, still support Bashar Assad, and there has not been a single advance made by the opposition, as this was possibly due to advice from Western players.
Primakov, referring to the double veto on the UN Security Council resolution on Syria, said that Russia and China, while not, in principle, rejecting the adoption of the UN Security Council resolutions, proposed that it fit the existing reality. The idea was to abandon the unacceptable wording from the standpoint of international law, which included the requirement of removing the lawfully elected government of President Bashar al-Assad, and not to support the bloodshed on either side, but to let the Syrian people decide their fate themselves.
Some provisions of the draft resolution proposed by a number of Western and Arab countries have caused some concerns. These provisions, as was the case with Libya, could possibly be used for an armed intervention in Syria.
Primakov writes that the resolution on Libya, which both Russia and China supported, practically allowed a military intervention, and the two countries do not want to be deceived again, recalling that the U.S. asked them not to veto the UN resolution on Libya, presenting it only as a requirement to enact a no-fly zone over the country to protect the civilian population. Then, the ambiguous part of the UN resolution was used to overthrow the Gaddafi regime.
Analyzing the diplomatic maneuvers of the various states surrounding Syria, the veteran Russian diplomat said that U.S. and its NATO allies want to take advantage of the situation that occurred in the spring of 2011, when the fires of Arab Spring swept through the Arab world in order to purge objectionable Arab regimes. Syria has become a victim mainly because it has close ties with Iran. Removing the current regime from power is part of the plan to isolate Iran.
In addition, Primakov drew attention to the divide between the two major religious branches in Islam, Sunni and Shia. After the American military operation in Iraq, the divisions between the two became especially strong. The Syrian government is represented mainly by Alawis, which has close ties to Shia Islam. Those Arab nations that support the Syrian opposition do so because of the strife between the Sunni and Shia Muslim branches, with many representatives of the predominantly Sunni nations fearing the creation of a Shia belt in the Mideast, from Iraq through Iran and Syria to Lebanon.
Meanwhile, as reported by Vatican Radio, the Syrian Christians feel fear and uncertainty about the future and abhor the future Islamization of Syria. According to Bishop Jean-Clement Jambara, Syrian Christians are afraid of seeing the Iraqi scenario being repeated when, after the U.S. military intervened and Saddam Hussein fell from power in 2003, there was a sharp Islamization of the country, which led to the exodus of Christians from Iraq. The notorious groups of hackers who call themselves Anonymous have been eavesdropping on FBI and Scotland Yard officers who are investigating them. In what seems to be the next chapter in the global cyber battle between the haunted hackers and various governments and corporations of the world, Anonymous have intercepted and released a confidential conference call between the two government agencies.
The intercepted conversation, which took place on the 17th of January, focused mostly on updates in the ongoing court cases against individuals that are believed to be part of Anonymous, and the recent arrest of a 15-year-old for hacking his school website. It appears that Anonymous managed to eavesdrop and record the audio after hacking an FBI email, which was also posted online. Writing on the Twitter account Anonymous IRC, one hacker said, "The FBI might be curious how we're able to continuously read their internal comms for some time now."
Aaron Higby, a cybersecurity specialist, told the Christian Science Monitor, "The most plausible scenario is that someone with Anonymous had access to an email account with a stolen password and was checking it for some time. They've been going after law enforcement for some time. The FBI investigation confirmed that the recording was intended for law enforcement officers only and was illegally obtained. However, no FBI systems were breached and that a criminal investigation is underway to identify and hold accountable those responsible.
In the recording, which Anonymous posted on YouTube, the intelligence officers discussed the ongoing court case against Ryan Cleary, who was arrested last June for his alleged role in the group LulzSec and reveals legally sensitive information. It also refers to a 15-year-old listed as a member of CSLSec, which means Can't Stop Laughing Security, and is a copycat group of hackers with just three members.
4 minutes into the 18-minute-long audio, the cybercrime investigators start talking about how to track and prosecute members of Anonymous. Who are his little group of friends, says a Scotland Yard investigator about one Anonymous member, adding, whether they're online friends or three-dimensional friends, I'm not sure.
The story is likely to have a further, even more damaging development. On the 3rd of February, a few hours following the FBI's announcement that the call had been intercepted, Anonymous revealed its plans to release a massive archive of emails concerning the deaths of the 24 unarmed Iraqi civilians during a U.S. raid in the town of Haditha in 2005. According to the collective, it managed to steal some 2.6 gigabytes of emails belonging to Pukif Farage, a law firm that represents Staff Sergeant Frank Woodrich, who is accused of greenlighting the shooting of the civilians in Haditha.
The hackers announced that the emails containing detailed records, transcripts, testimony, trial evidence, and legal defense donation records about the Haditha case will soon be posted to Pirate Bay, a BitTorrent site. The group's messages, quoted by the technology site Mashable, read, "As part of our ongoing efforts to expose the corruption of the court systems and the brutality of U.S. imperialism, we want to bring attention to USMC Surgeon Frank Woodrich, who, along with his squad, murdered dozens of unarmed civilians during the Iraqi occupation. Can you believe this scumbag had his charge reduced to involuntary manslaughter and got away with only a pay cut? We went ahead and fired off some shots of our own."
Other recent hacking achievements of Anonymous include taking down the website of Brazil's largest bank on Tuesday, temporarily blocking access to the websites of the U.S. Department of Justice, the FBI, the Copyright Office, the Motion Picture Association, the Recording Industry Association, and several other sites, posting a protest against austerity policies on Greece's Justice Ministry website Friday, as well as temporarily disabling two Swedish government sites.
What Anonymous themselves described as the single largest internet attack in its history was a response to the U.S. Department of Justice and the FBI's decision to close Mega Upload, a website providing file-sharing services, on January the 12th. The group's rise to fame is attributed to its attacks against PayPal and Visa in January 2011, in retaliation against those sites' economic blockade of WikiLeaks. Anonymous has no leaders and no clear membership and forms decisions collectively. Its main goal, as they say, is to safeguard the internet from repression and restriction of freedom of speech.
Those reports were from the Voice of Russia. Russia is now heard from 6 p.m. to 10 at 12030, 13665, 9840, and 7250, or through their website, www.english.ruvr.ru. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Standard Time. Please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing the show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcasts using a shortwave radio at home. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is also quite easy. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. On my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.